Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 17th of May. It's time for All Things Political, which we have each and every Monday here on the Ideas Network. We have two guests with us. Julie Mason has joined us many times before, who covers the White House for the Washington Examiner and blogs at Beltway Confidential. Later this hour, Juliana Goldman, White House reporter for Bloomberg News, will be joining us. A lot to talk about, some interesting primary elections tomorrow. We may start with that. We'll also be talking about this oil spill in the Gulf, which, according to News Now, threatens the Florida Keys. It just seems to be going on and on and on. And the political damage we will talk about. But first of all, of course, the environmental damage and what safeguards need to be put in place here. And we'll talk about Eleni Kagan and many more topics this hour. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email this morning, the email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And we start with Julie Mason, who covers the White House for the Washington Examiner. Hello, Julie. How are you?
Hi,
nice. I'm okay. Nice to have you on the air again.
Great. And Juliana's coming up after May. She's a great friend of mine.
Oh, is she?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, nice. Isn't that nice? I wish we were here together and we could share conversation, all three of us. Well, let's start with those primaries tomorrow. I'm kind of interested in Ron Paul's son in Kentucky. Can you tell us a little bit more about him? He's an up-and-comer, and he may indeed be winning.
He is. He's way ahead in the polls. Rand Paul. What a fascinating race that is, Kathleen. In Kentucky, it's boiling down to a real test between the establishment Republicans and the sort of insurgent Tea Party strain, which Rand Paul represents. And he's getting support from Sarah Palin and Jim DeMint. And I think he's going to win that race.
Do you really?
And what's interesting is his opponent, Trey Grayson, was endorsed by Mitch McConnell, who is a Senate minority leader. And so it's also coming down to a test of how popular is Mitch McConnell in his home state. And is this going to be another litmus test on the anti-incumbency sort of fervor that we see among voters this year? Is this going to be a repudiation of Mitch McConnell? Of course, Mitch McConnell says it's nothing of the sort. So,
and what's the story with Rand Paul? Is he a libertarian like his dad? What are his politics?
Very much like his dad. A lot in the same mold. His father is very proper man, very really believes in strictly the Constitution, as we saw during the campaign. And the son is a lot like that, too. And that's why the Tea Partiers have really embraced him.
Mm-hmm. And what does this bode for other races in the country? It seems like it's kind of a mixed up thing going on here. You've got some progressive Democrats in some areas running against more moderate Democrats. You've got Tea Party people running against conservative Republicans. What does all of that say?
It's hard to extrapolate one unifying message out of all of it. Part of the problem is turnout has been very low so far in these primaries we've seen. Turnout is always low in primaries, and especially in midterms. Like, you know, you never get more than 20%. But we've been writing and hearing about how voters are so angry, and they want to throw the bums down in Washington. But what we're seeing is this anger, which is a real thing, I think, isn't really translating into high turnout in the polls. So we're not seeing any consistent theme emerging. That's why everyone's looking to Tuesday to really try to figure out what is going on out there. We also have Pennsylvania, where Arlen Specter is running. You know, you remember he switched parties a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
He's running against Joe Sestak, who's a Democratic rep in the state. And the White House has gotten involved in that one, which it's really rare for a president and an administration to get involved when it's a disputed primary of their own party. Usually they wait until the primary's over and then endorse whatever Democrat wins. But in this case, they really went out on a limb for Arlen Specter, who could lose. You know, he supported Obama's stimulus package after he switched parties, and has really, you know, sort of he you know, has tried to be there for the president as he could. But now, after 30 years in the Senate, he might lose that seat.
Why?
Because he's just not popular in his home state. Joe Sestak has been running some incredibly powerful ads against him, saying Arlen Specter switched parties to save one job, his own.
Mm-hmm.
And Pennsylvania is very hard hit by this by this recession, and unemployment is still very high there. People aren't happy. They weren't happy with health care. They weren't happy with the stimulus. They're not happy with Arlen Specter, and since he is such an incumbent and such a symbol of the Senate, if it is true that there's this anti-incumbent fervor out there, that people just want to get rid of power in Washington, then Arlen Specter is such a powerful symbol of that.
Mm-hmm. So why is the president happy with Arlen Specter?
Well, because Specter has carried some water for him up on the Hill, and when Specter switched parties, he didn't just switch parties. I mean, he switched parties holding his nose a little bit, but he said, you know, Specter said yesterday on TV in his own defense, he was saying, I've always been independent. I've always, you know, taken my own path. But he really has done some things for Obama that helped Obama. So now Obama's returning the favor.
Mm-hmm. And from polls I saw, I think it was yesterday, Sestic is up 3 points. So it could be close or not.
Toss-up. It's definitely a toss-up.
How long has Specter been in office?
30 years.
Oh, my gosh, really?
No. Mm-hmm.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And Joe Biden is going to, I think Joe Biden is heading out there to stump for him today. So that'll be really, and so again, you know, a lot of people are seeing this sort of shape up as a referendum on Obama. If Democrats in Pennsylvania go for Joe Sestak, is that not just a repudiation of Arlen Specter, but is it also a rejection of, you know, the Obama administration on some level?
And is Sestak properly described as a progressive Democrat or not?
Yeah. He's certainly to the left of Arlen Specter, but that's not really hard in the Democratic Party right now.
Right, exactly. And the other one is Arkansas, Blanche Lincoln.
Right, absolutely. And that is a tough one. You know, she's a moderate Democrat. She voted for health care reform after they took out the public option. And that earned her a lot of problems in her home state from both sides, from Democrats who said, hey, we like the public option, and Republicans who said, how could you vote for that? And so she's got a challenger now, Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter, who is a little more liberal than she is. So what's going to happen there is whoever's going to win that Democratic primary on Tuesday is going to face a very tough challenge from the Republican Party in November. So whoever clears on Tuesday still has another tough fight. So Arkansas is going to be a tough one this year.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about turnout, do you expect that it's going to be pretty low tomorrow, Julie?
I do. Pennsylvania might be pretty good, but I mean, I think Kentucky and Arkansas, nowhere that's had a primary so far this year has seen really much over 23%, 25%. And that's pretty low. I mean, that's pretty standard for any old kind of, you know, primary in a midterm election year, but considering how much we've written and how much we've heard about voter anger and sort of voter agitation, I'm surprised. I'm surprised that it's not up to about 30%.
Hmm. So you think that just some of us are angry?
No, I think we're angry. We're just not doing anything about it. We're not going to go vote. We're so angry. We're just stuck.
We're stewing. We're just sitting here stewing. Yeah,
exactly.
Let's talk about this oil spill for a moment, which has gone on and on and on. The report today now is that it may have gone into the current and will affect the Gulf Coast. The Florida Keys. What a horrendous mess this is. Is there anything that can get this cleaned up? What are the political ramifications of this? What are the environmental ramifications of this?
Well, it's just terrible, Kathleen.
Isn't it?
Oh, my, it's just breathtakingly bad, and nothing seems to be working. We saw the president shift tones last week at the White House and come out very angry about what's happening and that it hasn't been able to be fixed. And you can see, I'm sure he is angry, and it is a problem, but you can also see the White House kind of turning a little bit and seeing how they can use this to their own political advantage. You certainly saw members of Congress hauling BP executives up there to explain themselves last week, and you definitely see Washington back to its old tricks, using the situation, much like the banks, to score some political points and say, hey, all right, here's someone who people will hate worse than us.
Right.
BP executives and BP. So they've become like the new bankers. You know, oil men are the new bankers in Washington. But the truth of the matter is, you know, whoever figures out how to fix this is going to be the hero. And I'm just not sure who that's going to be.
But you also at this time would expect that the government would be doing something. I don't know what anybody can do, but it's under this administration's watch in a sense.
It is.
So they need to do something.
Exactly. I think it was a little overstated and a little premature to call this Obama's Katrina, like some Republicans tried to do early on. But certainly, if this turns into the horrible environmental disaster that it appears to be, and the government is not able to respond, it's going to be a real problem for the president.
Yes.
And I think the White House is very worried about that.
I think so, too.
Especially because environmentalists are not happy with him so far. You know, he's pretty much dropped cap-and-trade legislation. He's not pushing it, and he really hasn't done much for the environmentalists. So they really want to see something from him quick.
Mm-hmm. Before we start taking phone calls, Laura Bush has said some interesting things in the last week. You've highlighted these. Hasn't she?
She certainly has. You know, it's funny because she is a tough lady, and she really kept that part of herself hidden during the Bush presidency. And when she came out with a book, I was wondering, is she going to show who she is, or is she going to write, like, a nice book? And she came out score-settling, saying what's what and who's who, and pointing fingers. And it's great to see her so liberated. She really is settling some scores. And people are really surprised by that, saying, wow, I thought she was just this mousy pie baker
right.
type lady. Nope.
No.
Meet Laura Bush. She's
yeah.
mad.
Yeah. And she thinks it's great that Elena Kagan has mm-hmm. been nominated. She's come out in favor of gay marriage.
and abortion rights.
Right.
And people are just, I know, their wigs are flying off over Laura Bush. It's very funny. It's very funny to see. It annoyed me a little bit because over the weekend she talked about how, you know, the media just really misconstrued her and how she was misportrayed by the media. And I had to kind of laugh and think, well, you contributed to that image. You made your own image. You nurtured it. You crafted it. And the media coverage of Laura Bush reflected that. And so now she's blaming the media. But that's in her nature, too. She's very, very unforgiving person.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political for this May 17. Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, is our guest for the first half hour of the program. We go to Pat from Richland. Hi, Pat.
Yes, good morning. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pat.
Julie, I'd like to just bear with me for maybe a minute and a half here. I, for one, have quite a bit of faith in the intelligence of the American people. I go to a lot of different political stuff and parties and stuff, and people are really pretty savvy. And then just a couple quick things that kind of runs a little contrary to that. Like you were just saying, everybody knows that Pennsylvania's been hit very hard by the recession, many job losses and so on. And doesn't it run a little contrary to why would people in Pennsylvania reject and be mad at somebody that tried to get more coverage for health care for more of them when they lost their job? That's number one. Number two, like, as far as health care goes, again, like after Kennedy got replaced in Massachusetts with a Republican, it's like Barack Obama and everybody else stood back and shut up about health care and thought it'd kind of go away because the only thing they were saying is, oh, the voters have spoken, nobody wants health care anymore. But then after a few weeks, then it came front and center again because they knew the American people were really mad and wanted them to do something about health care, and so they did something about it. And here's my point, okay, both of those things really kind of run against, if you give the American people any credit for brains, those two things really run contrary to that. But what about that there's no integrity in the election process? Look at 2004. Wouldn't you feel more confidence, Julie, in your speculation if you knew that the electoral process itself had some integrity?
I'm not sure what you mean by integrity. Are you referring to 2000?
Well, if there's been nothing that's changed, we all know that 2000 was stolen, and then after they stole it, the Bush group, they stood up in front of the country and waved at us and went, hey, man, we just stole this election for everybody to see, and there's not a darn thing you can do about it. And so, you know, we got to assume that things are just the same, and it's not just Florida. It was Ohio. It's probably all over. But, you know, does you see where that kind of ties together with so much of this going against, like, people with brains, like, you know, you're laid off from your job, so you're mad at somebody because they extend you health insurance? Does that make any sense?
Well, I take your point, Pat. I think that people didn't see, a lot of people in Pennsylvania and elsewhere in the country didn't see health care reform as something that was going to help them. I think the opponents of health care reform waged a very effective campaign to convince people that it was not going to help them, that it was that it was just going to cost a lot of money and not really do much. And so I think that people were really divided over it, and we certainly saw that in the polls. And even now, it seems like half the people aren't even sure that healthcare is going to do them any good at all. So I think that is part of what played out in Pennsylvania. Does that kind of go to your question?
You think people are that stupid?
Well, I don't think they're stupid. I think it's easier to reach an easy conclusion than try to figure out. I mean, healthcare reform was so complicated, it was such a mess. And you're right, they kind of let it go and kind of stepped away from it. And then at the very last minute, they saw an opportunity and went roaring back in and passed it, you know, over a weekend that was just an incredibly tumultuous time. They really did kind of ram it through when they saw they had an opportunity to do so. And I think a lot of us were surprised that Obama was even able to do that. But I don't think it goes to people's stupidity. I think people are busy, and I think that they want to trust the government and can't and don't know who to believe, and they're bombarded by messages. And I think maybe sometimes people are a little bit lazy, but I don't think they're stupid.
Julie Mason, our guest for the first part of All Things Political. Our number is 800-486-8655. Couple lines are open. Thanks for your call, Pat. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, you'll recall the interview we did, which was pretty dramatic, with the author of Murder City, the murder capital of the world, which is Juarez, Mexico. Our guest led us to believe that a lot of the lawlessness is and the immigration problems that we are having in this country is because of NAFTA. Before NAFTA, Mexico, he said, had a large and thriving middle class and a viable farm economy. But as a result of NAFTA, people lost those mid-sized factory jobs and their farming jobs, and they came across the border to find work. So it got us thinking about NAFTA, and we're going to have two different viewpoints on how successful or not successful NAFTA has been the second hour of our show today. Julie Mason is with us now. We go to Tony from Fond du Lac. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
I'm very good. My big question with BP is, as soon as it happened, they started talking about being able to drop a dome or make a dome to drop over the oil well, you know, the spewing broken oil pipe, whatever, on the bottom of the ocean a mile down. And they didn't start on that for 10 days. Then they're trying to recover oil, and they're trying to take oil out of the pipe by putting another pipe in and trying to pump it out faster than it's actually coming out under pressure. Well, if this were the 60s, or if this were an engineering problem, they could have, or not maybe completely blocked the well, but just by dropping tons of rock or taking a deep-sea submarine and found some way to block off the well. It seems to me they're more worried about the oil they can get out of the well than they're worried about the oil that is getting into the ocean. And when this turns into a political problem like it has, all we see as citizens, since you're talking about polling and everything too, the blame game, because the Democrats and the Republicans are still fighting over who's going to take charge or who has the best idea, while even with the healthcare situation that the last caller brought up, when is our government going to stop fighting over who's in charge or who's to blame, just like with the oil leak, who's to blame for it, and actually take action and do things?
Yeah, get something fixed, for heaven's sake. Julie.
I know, that's such a good point. And we see these situations, these crises, really instantly develop into finger-pointing and blame because each side sees how they can turn it to their advantage. And I think that's just the nature of politics, especially at this level in Washington. It makes you wonder, why didn't they have a plan for this? I mean, this must have happened before, right?
Exactly.
And we saw them trying to immerse that dome or whatever that was, and that didn't work. And now you just feel so helpless thinking of that oil spewing. And it's right. They do seem to be thinking about how they're going to keep making money off this deal rather than averting this horrible disaster.
It is hard to believe that there wasn't a requirement for a system to be in place in case something like this horrible disaster happened.
It's just the oil companies are so powerful. They really are. And, you know, already there's a lot of talk in Washington about forcing BP to compensate people, you know, fishermen and other people on the coast who are affected by it. And there's certainly some resistance to that, even in Washington among politicians who feel like, you know, the government doesn't have a role in forcing private companies to compensate people for losses like that. So that's part of the debate, too. It's kind of breathtaking.
Yes. Thanks, Tony. Jim, hi.
Hi. Today I'd like to just say something about words, because I think that liberals have been behind the curve on use of words to make their point. And I actually got the idea from a conservative book by Frank Luntz. For example, conservatives will talk about lobbyists. Liberals should call lobbyists greed specialists. Another example, conservatives should stand behind, should and do stand behind strong enforcement of laws, whereas, at least in regards to corporations, conservatives want to put the law enforcement behind us. And look at the action verbs. Liberals could use action verbs like observing, listening, initiating, enforcing, and caring, but the conservative action verbs are drilling and polluting, denying, obstructing, resisting, justifying, minimizing, diverting, delaying, and manipulating. I think we should take a look at the use of the words, because they describe the real actions that are going on.
That's really interesting, and there's so much thought that goes into political messaging. It's really true. You know, I think liberals have tried to capitalize. For example, you mentioned lobbyists, on sort of anti-lobbyist feeling, but that never really caught on. You know, it's sort of like a Washington concern. I think people are uncomfortable with the idea of lobbyists, but then you always hear, you know, there's some lobbyists who are lobbying for good things. And when you try to outlaw all the bad ones, you're going to catch some good ones in your net, too. So that sort of line of thinking didn't really follow. But it's true. I would also add that conservatives are for deregulation, you know, and that's something that people fall on both sides of.
Thank you, Jim, for your always interesting calls. Elena Kagan, do you foresee any problems in confirmation?
Yes, I do.
Do you?
Yeah, it's been kind of a snoozer so far, and she seems like kind of a, almost like a safe choice for him. But I think this country, Kathleen, is so polarized and so entrenched that there is no way that these two parties are going to let this thing go through easily. I think everyone's going to have to posture and make their points and huff and puff and storm around. I think she'll get confirmed in the end, but I think it's going to be a little tougher maybe than even Sotomayor.
Hmm. And the issues that are of concern, number one, the military on campus?
Right, the military,
yes.
Yeah, and they're going to, you know, they're going to use sort of gays in the military as a proxy to sort of allude to her own sort of sexual orientation, and there's going to be a lot of, like, raised eyebrows, and, you know, a lot of it is going to be sort of whisper campaign stuff, but also she doesn't have much of a record, and that's what Republicans are talking about, so they're really going to be keying on her testimony, and I think we're going to see her playing it very, very safe in these hearings, so she doesn't give them any ammunition.
Julie, thank you so much for being with us. Happy new week to you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks,
it's
Julie.
A pleasure.
Yeah, great pleasure to have you, too. Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, our first guest for All Things Political. We're going to welcome now Juliana Goldman, who's a White House reporter for Bloomberg News. Same areas of discussion, and we'll branch into other areas as well. Let me give you our phone number. You're so welcome to join All Things Political, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that, talk@WPR.org. Interesting primaries in Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and Arkansas tomorrow, so we are talking a little bit about that, what we expect the voter turnout to be, and the challenges, libertarian challenge. Rand Paul, who looks like he probably will win in Kentucky. Arlen Specter facing a difficult race in Pennsylvania. Blanche Lincoln getting a challenge as well. Is this, do you think, or is the press making too much of this, that's an anti-incumbency thing going on and it's going to get only bigger? Or considering the small number of people who are showing out for these kinds of races, is it just people from either progressive Democrats or Tea Party activists who are showing up at the polls and everybody else is taking a pass right now? Juliana Goldman joining us now. Hi, Juliana.
Hi, it's great to be with
you. Yeah, very great to have you with us as well. We were speaking with Julie Mason who's a good friend of yours, I guess. So that was kind of nice.
We sit right next to each other at the White House. So
oh, do you really?
Yeah.
Oh, then you are good friends. That's great. We were talking about tomorrow's primaries, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the most interesting, the most significant of the three races that we tend to be concentrating on, Pennsylvania, Arkansas, and Kentucky. Which one most fascinates you?
Well, I think actually for me, it's a bit of a tie between Arkansas and Pennsylvania. I mean, just the looking at Pennsylvania, the pure politics of the switch from Republican to Democrat, and then, okay, well, where has that got you now? I think that is pretty interesting. Also, covering the White House, I think it's interesting that the president isn't there today, that he wasn't there over the weekend. As also a reporter for Bloomberg News, with such a focus and emphasis on the economy and markets, regulatory reform is probably the biggest issue for us now. And there's a fascinating piece in the Post today about the sort of anti-TARP, anti-bailout fervor that's really evident in the midterm, in these primaries just in general, and Blanche Lincoln, how people are calling her bailout Blanche, and the idea that her derivatives provision that she's trying to get into the regulatory reform bill, that it goes so far, you know, that Paul Volcker, the White House, is trying to scale it back, but all to get out from under the bailout Blanche, the TARP proponent label. So I just think the dynamics in play in both those states are really fascinating, and you know, we're going to be able to study the results and see then how all that is going to play out through the fall.
And will you, as a result of these races, be able to make some predictions about the fall? We were speaking with Julie about how voter turnout is expected to be pretty low. Does that preclude any kind of hunch about what will, or informed hunch about what will happen next fall?
I think one of the great things about the Obama team and the movement is the sort of grassroots effort and how they were able to mobilize young voters, various demographics in 2008. And so I think depending on what kind of turnout you see, I think that's going to be a real barometer in terms of where that that grassroots, those sort of efforts need to be focused.
And who's calling her bailout Blanche?
constituents, but really, it's sort of the anti-big government. There's people, voters who have are really, their biggest issue is that government is playing too big a role right now, and from their perspective, TARP. Even though many of the companies, the big banks, have repaid those funds, there's sort of a sense of, well, all is working out and fair on Wall Street, and they've been helped and propped up by here, but here on Main Street, we're still struggling. And so this sense that her vote, her record has been to help Wall Street, to help the big banks, and not Main Street.
And what would it take, do you think, to placate those who believe that?
That's a good question. I think if I had that, I could be making a lot more money as a political strategist than as a political reporter. But I think that is the big question that's out there, whether or not, it certainly doesn't seem like proposing such a strict derivatives ban or limit of derivatives was necessarily the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to Pennsylvania for a moment. Why hasn't the president, he's supporting Specter, but why hasn't he campaigned in the state somewhat vigorously for him?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It seems like the White House sort of learned the lesson from New Jersey and Virginia several months ago by heading out there as sort of a last-ditch effort. And then the story, instead of the focus being on the candidates, on Wednesday or even Tuesday night or Tuesday heading into, and also the same with Massachusetts, is the story then becomes about why wasn't the president able to bring it home. And I think to the extent that they can avoid this and sort of look at these elections as lessons and studies for the upcoming midterms. It seems like that's the strategy that's going on in the White House right now.
Hmm. It is hard to imagine. This does happen every now and then. Somebody whose name you know, Arlen Specter, a lot of people know his name because he's been there so darn long, but it's hard to imagine that a guy like that wouldn't be there anymore.
Yeah. No, it's sort of, it speaks to the anti-incumbent, whether you are, you know, an 80-year-old veteran of the Senate who has a very established record and familiarity with the state, with the electorate, that you know, there is something brewing out there that is just really feeding into this anti-incumbent fervor that you saw in the 2008 election also, mm-hmm. that we've just been seeing really pronounced over these past couple years.
And what about Rand Paul? Is there just a small group of people who are just wild about him and libertarian kind of politics? And how does that play into what's going to happen in the fall?
Yeah, I don't really think that you can discredit that election either. I mean, I think that in terms of the effect of the Tea Party movement and what kind of role that is going to play, that movement is going to play in the fall, I think that you'll be able to tell a lot based on what happens tomorrow in Kentucky. I mean, whether not only in terms of studying the Tea Party movement, but the kind of reinforcement, the kind of validation that the movement itself might feel after that, and how then that will translate into their own activities.
What about the issue of jobs, Juliana? It seems to me as though the administration hasn't taken that on in a huge way, and people are kind of stalled with their work, with their incomes. They're not getting raises. They're getting furloughs, many of them. We're not making significant movement on that front. Do any of these races address that issue?
Well, of course, jobs in the economy is the underlying factor, and I think when you talk about, you know, the frustrations with Wall Street, that Wall Street has gotten this bailout and Main Street hasn't really. I think that one of the underlying themes of that is, okay, well, Wall Street is starting to make record profits. These guys are getting big bonuses again, and we're still dealing with 9.9% unemployment. I think the one thing that is interesting, I was just looking at Gallup polling, and in their latest poll, jobs as an issue in and of itself has ticked under economy as the general issue in terms of what Americans are most concerned about. Jobs are sort of taking a second place to the overall economy now. But, you know, the administration, I think, and with reason, might sort of dispute some of the idea that they aren't dealing with jobs front and center. I mean, last month's the number of jobs created was way above 100,000, more than 100,000 additional jobs than had been expected, and unemployment ticking up shows that more Americans, more of the jobless, are feeling confident enough to go and try and find jobs again. But the president tomorrow, for example, he's going to be in Youngstown, Ohio, talking about jobs. I think from the president's mouth, and the message from the White House, in many of the appearances that he's going to be making, you're going to be hearing a concerted focus on jobs, and also pointing to the stimulus as a big credit for in general Americans seeing more jobs added each month.
Juliana Goldman is our guest for All Things Political this half hour. She is White House reporter for Bloomberg News and coincidentally sits next to the guest we had on the previous half hour, Julie Mason, when they report from the White House. We continue with your phone calls. We'll go to them in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. The second hour of our program, we'll look at the North American Free Trade Agreement 17 years after it was signed by the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. One of our guests who wrote the really disturbing book, Murder City, was with us last week, and it got all of us thinking long and hard about NAFTA, and if indeed it is true, as he stated, that one of the big reasons for the immigration problem in this country is due to NAFTA, which he believes has pretty much destroyed the job possibilities for small farmers, for people who used to work in smaller factories, that they're not making any money and they're crossing the border illegally to find work in the United States. We'll talk about that. We'll have a debate about that, hour number two. All right, to you again in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We go to phone calls now for Juliana and Joe from Black River Falls. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Joy. I enjoy your show.
Thanks, but it's Kathleen.
Kathleen, yeah. Sorry. And Julianne, right?
Yes.
So anyways, I just wanted to make a comment about, I want to get Julianne's comments about what's going on in Barack Obama's Senate seat that he vacated. But then also, just another comment about the previous caller. His name was Pat, I believe, and I just incensed with his arrogance with regards to people who may not agree with him, you know, with regards to, say, health care or what have you, that somehow or another they're stupid, you know. And I think a lot of folks take exception to that kind of attitude, and I think that's where the anger comes in. And that kind of arrogance I sense in the administration and in Congress by ramrodding legislation through like that. It's just a sense of arrogance.
Ramrodding what? Ramrodding healthcare?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And given, you know, for many of us, given a choice of a job or healthcare, we'd rather have a job. And we know that we want healthcare reform. We want it to be better. But it doesn't necessarily mean we want to throw out the old system, and the system, by that current legislation, it'll just disintegrate because we'll be in competition. The private industry will be in competition with the government, and the government doesn't need to make a profit, and therefore they lose. So, anyways, but I do want to hear what you have to say about about Barack Obama's Senate seat.
Okay, thank you for your call.
Yeah, thank you. You know, my colleague out in Chicago, John McCormick, has been following this much much more closely. But that of course, is an certainly an interesting race to watch. And it brings through a lot of the president's local Chicago connections. He had been very close to Alexei during his Chicago career, and Junilius was on the campaign trail quite a bit. He sometimes played basketball with the president on election days. I think as this Broadway Bank controversy heats up, it'll be interesting to see whether the president wades into that territory. And I would guess that he probably, will stay clear of some of those specifics, but while of course endorsing the Democrat in the race as opposed to somebody who he has those previous connections with.
What about Joe's use of the word ramrodding? You hear that quite a bit from people who are opposed to this current administration and to the Congress. They're ramrodding legislation through. It's used frequently, that description.
Yeah, it's used frequently. I think it's a pretty loaded term, it's certainly something that it would speak to some of the concerns about the administration wading into using government to just taking a much stronger hand when it comes to government interventions. But it certainly is something that we're hearing quite a bit, and probably a term that you will continue to hear through the fall.
Mm-hmm. Scott in Green Bay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning. Yeah, you're right about that term. The interesting thing is during the Bush administration, when the Republicans had the House and the Senate, it was used then also by the Democrats.
Sure, sure.
So it's kind of, you know, it's tit for tat is what it is. What the story that I'm kind of interested in is this, and I'm wondering if this is going to play into the elections at all when it comes to national security and civil liberties. This potential attempt by Holder and the Obama administration to weaken Miranda, whereas this clause regarding public safety is, well, maybe we may not have to Mirandize people for, what is it, 30 or 60 or 90 days? And why that interests me so much is because there is no doubt that if this were John Ashcroft and George Bush looking at weakening Miranda, the sky would be falling. I mean, that's all you would hear in the news, is that they are trying to weaken Miranda, eliminate it, and diminish our civil liberties. I'm just wondering why that isn't more of a story, and whether that may play into some of the elections this year.
Yeah, I think that it certainly will play. I think when you ask why, here I can put on my media analyst hat, is that there's only so much bandwidth out there. And when you look at just everything that's been going on in the last couple of weeks, I think Holder made those statements on ABC's with Jake Tapper last week. And when you think about then Elena Kagan, the BP oil spill, the fallout from the terrorist attack, the attempted terrorist attack in Times Square, there was just a lot going on in the last week. So I think that could be one of the issues that starts to percolate and bubble up as maybe some of the other major headlines start to fall. But it is certainly something that is simmering, and I would totally expect that it will come up.
Let's talk a little bit about the oil spill. Such a horrendous event, and it just, as we were talking about with Julie, flabbergasted me that it just kept spewing, and we have a little bit of a containment now for days and days and days and days, and the ocean's looking awful, and now the coast is being threatened, and animals are coated with oil, and it just drives me crazy that it hasn't been able to be fixed. I'm wondering who's to blame for all of this, and what will happen. I know you concentrate on economic matters. What will happen to, I don't know, the price of goods and to this particular oil company and the economic ramifications of all of this?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, you talk about the frustration that you've seen by seeing these images, and you know that is something that this administration, this White House, they've known for the last several weeks, ever since that rig explosion, and then when we started to see that it was leaking, you know, more 5,000 barrels a day as opposed to 1,000 barrels a day, and now who knows how many barrels a day it's leaking. But what reports seem to indicate last week was that it is way above 5,000 barrels of oil a day. And in terms of the blame game and the frustrations, you know, that is a tone that you're starting to hear more pronounced from the administration and from the president himself. I think a lot of people were sort of not surprised by the tone that the president used last week on Friday when he came out, and he really chastised the BP execs and Transocean, Halliburton for finger pointing and sort of he said that they were falling over one another at the hearings last week. And so one of the things that this administration, they have been trying to do, is make sure that they are putting the spotlight on BP, that this is their responsibility, that this is not the government that needs to bear, that should be held accountable. It's interesting when you look at some polling. So far, they seem to be winning that. The administration seems winning that, just barely, though. You know, with there, I think there was the public is sort of split on whether the government is to blame for this, whether the government bears responsibility. I think it was 45% saying that the government has done enough. I saw in the Wall Street Journal poll last week, 50% saying that BP hasn't done enough. And so there is a really thin margin there. And so I think that's why there's sort of this public campaign in a way to put pressure on BP to make sure that they are going to cover all the damages, whether it is in excess of that $75 million liability cap, but that they are going to act in good faith and keep their word.
And why is it, Juliana, that that gas prices haven't gone up significantly as a result of this?
Because I think what I've been able to gauge, and from what I've been seeing, and I'm not a commodities reporter at Bloomberg, but that a lot of this oil wasn't factored into being online yet. This was an exploratory well.
I see.
And so it wasn't factored into the pricing. Of course, you know, we're heading into the summer where prices tend to go up anyway, and also to hurricane season. And so this summer is going to be a pretty telling time.
You just feel so sorry for all these people who live there, and they don't know what the extent of this will be, and they're living with that kind of horrendous ambiguity.
And the memories of Katrina also,
yes,
for the Gulf Coast.
Right.
I mean, this is a region and populace that has been so battered by events beyond their control. And it also speaks, I think, the frustrations that the president, he said that when he was down there, people were angry. And so last week he was sort of channeling that anger. But that kind of anger is dangerous politically, and you saw that in Katrina.
Right. Thanks for the call, Scott. We go next to Bob from Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hello. I have a question, since you have been watching and keeping track of the heartbeat of what's going on in Washington, D.C., and there is this law in the state of Arizona that really mimics the federal law regarding immigrants, as well as you know, the illegal trafficking of drugs and other things that are coming across the border from Mexico. And I believe that the main reason that law was passed, based on what I've been able to research, is that the citizens of Arizona were getting sick and tired of having their property damaged and the drug running and the guns and the all kinds of things that were going on, and the government didn't seem to be taking action. And haven't heard much about it in the news lately, but I did read something just recently that the Unitarian organization is looking to vote this June to have their General Assembly removed from Arizona in 2012. And it just absolutely flabbergasts me, because the president has been misquoted on this law, as well as a number of other politicians. I was wondering if the tone in Washington on this has changed, because, again, I haven't heard anything about it in a while.
What do you mean by the president's been misquoted?
In the Unitarian Universalist Organization, they have the UU World magazine, and their editor actually quoted the president of the United States saying that this law is unfair because they can stop anybody at any time and ask them just because they think that they're not a citizen. And the law is actually written to say that they have to stop them for another reason. So for even if I was stopped, for instance, for a traffic violation, and a law officer asked me for my driver's license, if I can't produce it, I think I would be detained too. And that's the way the law is written. That's the word of the law. But the president was quoted as saying he believes they can stop at any time just for a suspicion of not being a citizen.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that quote, it does sound like what the president did say after a few weeks ago, but it really does speak to the immigration debate and what we are going to see, what kind of role this will be playing in the midterms. You know, a few weeks ago there were massive protests here in Washington and around the country, anti-immigration kinds of protests, and they really went uncovered. And that's actually something that officials in the White House took notice of with surprise. And I think that when you see, you mentioned NAFTA is going to be an issue that you're going to be discussing,
yes,
in the next segment, but when Felipe Calderon is here this week, immigration is also, of course, going to be front and center. So I think, you know, if we were concerned that, that there weren't enough, there wasn't a big focus on immigration in light of that new law over the last few weeks, I think that you'll be seeing a lot more of that this week in light of that visit.
I think you're absolutely right. It's going to be a huge issue. It is a huge issue. And as you say, the media tends to not report on it. And then they're caught by surprise when they see the enormity of these rallies. They've happened in the past.
Yeah, yeah. And again, it gets back to the whole bandwidth issue. And there's only so much that that can make headlines and lead the news reports. But certainly, if the media didn't take note of it the way that it should, the White House did, and they know that this is going really going to be a hot issue.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you so much, Juliana, for being with us for our regular Monday All Things Political. Thank you.
Oh, great to be with you. Thank you.
Juliana Goldman, our guest this half hour, White House reporter for Bloomberg News. Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, our guest earlier this hour, talking about all things political. There are many. And we are going to do a full hour of talk about NAFTA and the effects on NAFTA. I thought that Bob made some interesting points that people who live in that area are concerned about lawlessness in Arizona and drugs, et cetera. We're going to look at the effects of NAFTA on workers in the United States, but probably more pertinent to our conversation, what's happened to people in Mexico as a result of NAFTA. Thanks to Rhonda Fanny for producing this hour and doing on-air production as well. We return following the news.